Mon corps est à moi, et c'est moi qui sais si je veux ou pas mettre bas. Faire ce bas monde des enfants ou pas, être plate ou ronde, j'ai le choix.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, and I'm not joined this week by my good friend, the Bud Abbott to my Lou Costello, the Dean Martin to my Jerry Lewis, Luke Savage. Unfortunately, Luke has fallen ill. He was in Massachusetts in advance of Super Tuesday canvassing for Bernie Sanders. He's back now, but unfortunately, he's quite sick. His voice is shot. But folks, we're show business professionals here, and the show must go on. And that's why this week, we're doing something a little bit different. I'm joined by friend of the show, Violet Luca, web editor at Harper's Magazine, film critic for a variety of publications. Longtime listeners will remember her from our Borat and They Live episodes. We're having a discussion about the history of abortion on film, inspired by an essay that Violet recently wrote called A Womb of One's Own. Luke will be back next week, and Patreon subscribers, we hope to have a little more bonus content for you this month as well. In the meantime, here's me and Violet.
Je suis peintre. L'homme intéressé par ma fille est milanais. Nous partons là-bas si le portrait lui plaît. L'a épuisé déjà un peintre avant vous.
I'm glad you're here to talk about abortion, actually, because, you know, there are many issues that perhaps we kind of err on the side of caution about being, you know, straight, cis, white men, etc. You know, sticking to the kind of brochalist stuff. But your article was prompted by the new movie Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which I was able to see on the weekend. Could you just briefly describe how is abortion treated in that movie, and how does it differ from the way it's typically treated in movies, if it's treated at all?
I was very moved by how it was portrayed because, again, as you say, it is a very rare way of dealing with it. The depiction of abortion in A Portrait of a Lady on Fire is unique for several reasons. So typically when we see abortion represented on screen, at least in the US and in Canada and Western Europe, etc., it's usually a middle class to upper class woman who is concerned about her career. That's a very narrow segment of society. And it's also usually a white woman. Again, a very narrow segment of society. So Portrait of a Lady on Fire is the woman who requires an abortion is a young maid, and she's the only other person on this island that is left with these two women, the woman who is to be painted and the woman who is going to do the painting. And at first, you know, the way it comes up is so casually because the painter is awoken one night by menstrual cramps and she ask for some assistance, you know, just warm cherry stones, which is, again, you know, like if you see your girlfriend doing a hot compress, that's probably what's going on with her, FYI. But
these are the kind of things I don't need to know, but okay.
Get ready for more. So, you know, they're making small talk and the maid brings up the fact that she hasn't had her period in several months. And the painter says, well, do you want a child? And the maid says no. And so then there's this small subplot of the maid trying to induce an abortion. So this involves running back and forth, like until she's breathless, hanging from a beam on a ceiling, searching a field for flowers that could induce an abortion, making a tea out of it. All these really kind of dangerous things that, again, you might have an idea you could do them through, you know, oral tradition, let's say. And eventually they realize that's not working. So they go to visit a woman who specializes in these things. And during the procedure, the woman who is being painted tells the woman who is the painter, please watch this. So the procedure takes place, you know, the maid is lying on a bed and the midwife or abortionist's other children are kind of running around and there's a baby on the bed. And, like, I saw this with my boyfriend, and he was like, oh, that's just too much. But that's probably how it was. I mean, because for most of recorded history, these were things that were handed down woman to woman. Midwives took care of pregnancies and terminating pregnancies, because they were the ones who had that knowledge. And it wasn't until sort of the professionalization of medicine in the 19th century that these sorts of things were stamped out and there started being laws against abortions. So the maid in this scene, she starts crying and she's holding the baby's hand. And it's sort of like, a thing that can happen when you're having an abortion is feeling elated. But she's also seeing like what could be, but is also totally happy in her decision. And, having an abortion will, allow her to continue supporting herself financially. It will not bring any trouble to her family. It won't bring any trouble to the guy that she messed around with. Like, it's just one of those things that is, it's presented as this totally right thing to do. But it isn't said out loud necessarily. And then later that night, when she's recovering from the abortion, the noblewoman who is being painted tells the painter, go get your stuff. And she restages the procedure. So the maid has her knees up and the noblewoman sort of poses as the abortionist. And it's such a powerful statement on what representation can do. And the knowledge that this is something kind of secret that they observed, and that they can preserve this moment through an image as they see it, and existing totally outside of the male gaze. So that's why I got a little teary-eyed.
Even though I read your article, I was caught a little off guard by it, because it is something that's depicted very matter-of-factly in the film, and that happens in the midsection of the film. So it's not even the climactic moment of the film. When I think of kind of what are the definitive abortion scenes in movies, I think of something like in Cabaret, maybe towards the end, where Liza Minnelli has the abortion off screen. And it's basically the inciting incident that gives the Michael York character and the audience permission to write her off. Like it's always a rather consequential and even in ostensibly pro-choice movies, it's always weighted with enormous significance.
Oh, yeah. And it's always, and it's portrayed as fatal a lot of the time, even though it is something that is very rarely fatal. Like even The Sopranos, Adriana Laserva, she can't get pregnant with Michael because she had an abortion when she was young. She was 16. That is very rare to become infertile from an abortion. Like even in things that I really like, it is this point of, someone is going to die, they're going to commit suicide, they're going to miscarry anyway, like something just bad is going to happen because they've been marked for death because maybe kind of they want an abortion.
You were telling me that you watched the first movie, or I guess the first movie we know of to feature an abortion, which is a film from 1916. What was that film?
It's called Where Are My Children? And it's directed by Philip Smalley and Lois Weber. Lois Weber, who is sort of trying to be recuperated as this feminist icon. She made a lot of blockbusters during her time in silent Hollywood. However, this probably won't come out on special edition Kino DVD Blu-ray. The premise of this story, it is a full-throated defense of abortion. However, that defense is entirely eugenicist. So it's about this DA who is prosecuting this vaguely foreign man called Dr. Herman Malfit, which is presumably Latin for bad fit. And he's giving abortion to all these women, and a lot of them are wealthy women. Some of them are women he knows. He may even be married to one of those women. And the message of the film is basically that poor people should get abortions, and rich women who do get abortions are like louche party animals, and they deserve to be, ostracized and punished. The scene that's most stuck in my mind is the end, where there's sort of like these superimposed images of their children as adults. And, they grow old and they're just sitting and like moldering away in their chairs in their empty house, and they're beautiful, young children are in their smoking jackets and in their high waist, your empire waisted clothes. And like, there's this this amazing thing that the rich, selfish wife denied the DA. Where are my children? But also it's just like you have to deal with this history, this part of the history of abortion, right? Like you can't act like this doesn't exist. That people like Margaret Sanger were eugenicists and they did push these things in order to control the population, to clean up inferior races, because that was the dominant all over the world. That was like the dominant way of thinking about things. That was scientifically rational. But we also have to go back further than that and say, well, across the world, all over the world, in ancient texts that have survived, in bas reliefs that have survived, there are abortions. So when somebody wants to go to that place, a conservative person wants to go to that place and be like, well, you know, Susan B. Anthony was a giant racist, you could say, yes, but she didn't fucking invent abortion, okay? Like, we could go past that. There are a lot of sciences and a lot of social issues that did get caught up in eugenicist ideas. And I mean, I just mention this because I feel like even, you know, on the left, there is a tendency when you are fighting for something that seems, you know, like more rights, basically, right? You can internalize the opposition, because when people criticize Bernie Sanders for being like an old white guy who's for like white bros, blah, 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 Bernie bros, there's these online assassins that are making fun of people. You can internalize that. I know some women who have internalized heterosexuality, comp-het, which is termed by Adrienne Rich. So there are a lot of women who don't realize they're gay until they're in their 30s because they've had time to think about it. And this has nothing to do with not knowing yourself. This has nothing to do with not being in touch with who you are. This has nothing to do with being socially conservative. It's just something that it is just such a part of our culture, the idea of marriage, of this is the goal. And you're being pushed that way by everything around you in society that you don't realize it until you're much older. And so, I mean,
yeah, you don't realize it's a possibility even.
Exactly. Yeah. So like when we're dealing with something like abortion and there's pro-choice and pro-life, when you're using pro-life, you're kind of losing the argument because it's such a loaded term. And even heartbeat bills. The heartbeat bills are saying that electrical signals that are appearing after a certain number of weeks in the place where the heart will eventually form, if it is allowed to form, is a heartbeat. And that's fucking ridiculous. It's sort of like twisting science around and trying to use it against people who are pro-choice. So I think it's really important. I mean, again, why I found Portrait of a Lady on Fire really important is because it's taking these ideas that, again, we're treating as natural and de-internalizing them and saying, hey, there's something beyond the way that we think about these things.
I'm assuming there weren't many depictions of abortion in Hollywood studio era movies. Did you find any others in the silent era, or was there a point, I guess, maybe after the studio era when depictions became more common?
Well, pre-code Hollywood, there were some films that would like hint at it, very strongly hint at it. And even in shows like Peyton Place, which was a big melodrama of the 1950s, of course, a favorite of David Lynch, abortion was a plot on that show in the 1950s. And the weird thing is that once abortion was legalized in the United States, the depictions of it in films went away, ostensibly because they didn't want to offend a certain portion of their audience, right? And also because, well, is it already solved? Do we want to weigh in? No, we don't. So let's just pretend like this isn't an option at all. And so I think that silence is probably more damning than something that was overtly anti-abortion. Or, you know, and again, it gets back to this idea of like solving an unwanted pregnancy with having someone die, commit suicide, et cetera, like working around it without actually comprehensively dealing with the issue. And I just think it's chicken shit, but it's also more damaging to somebody, to a young woman who is watching these sorts of things. And that's all you see. And that's all you know about this thing.
In your article, you trace how abortion has been depicted in films by both male directors and female directors. Are these two distinct traditions? Do these two, I guess, types of abortion movies, is there coherence in male depictions and female depictions? I didn't ask that very well, but you get the point.
I mean, I didn't go into it thinking that there would be, but definitely looking at the more sort of high-profile films. I mean, obviously, I'm not looking at stuff like the extreme
Unplanned.
Yeah, unplanned. I'm not looking at unplanned. Like, fuck that. Was that even directed by a woman? I don't care. I don't have time for that. But, you know, if you look at something like Claude Chabrol's Story of Women, which stars Isabelle Huppert, it's sort of based on an actual woman in Vichy, France, who was giving abortions and was guillotined for it, if you can believe that or not. They still have the guillotine around. France is a weird place. Anyway, you know, the way Chabrol represents it, you know, and of course, he's coming from this auteurist tradition. So when we see an audience surrogate, you know, it can also be a surrogate for the director. And I think, you know, the way in which abortion is shown, which is mostly through the procedure itself, is shown through like little keyholes and like a little boy peeking around and trying to see what his mom and all these women are doing. It is this distance between the female body and the male body. And I don't want to get all Freudian or something. Probably a better example would be something like 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, where just the most, it shows the procedure, but it just heightens these very gross aspects of it. It makes this procedure gross. And of course, it's just this giant metaphor for the state's control over the body, and how even in, you know, the black market, the state has control. And like, it's not just a not positive representation of it, but it's just looking at it in this entirely different way that's separated from female bodies.
4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, for those who haven't seen it, is depicted in the waning days of the Soviet Union in Romania, where abortion is outlawed, and these two female characters, one of them pregnant, the other her friend, try to procure a black market abortion from a very sleazy abortionist who the friend ends up trading sexual services for it. And as you point out in the article, there's a strong suggestion that the friendship may not survive this after it's over. Well, a lot of people, when that movie came out, pointed out that it's a pro-choice movie in the sense that the characters in the movie are not actually allowed a choice.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Do you like that film? I wasn't quite sure reading the article. where do you come down on it?
It's hard because it is such a, you know, when Ottila has the fetus in a bag, and she's just wandering around and trying to find a place to throw out this aborted fetus, which again you see very up close. It's kind of like a horror movie. But that's also the point, right? It's that this is what repressive regimes do to everyone, but specifically women, to specifically young women who are vulnerable, who have no other choice but to move forward. Like, it's a hard thing. I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm ever going to put on 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days and just like chill out to it. That's not the point of that movie. And I think it uses its unsettlingness for its purpose. However, I think if that film was directed by a woman, there would be different choices made about how women's bodies are portrayed. And, you know, just like when he's about to do the actual abortion and Gabita, who's the woman who is pregnant, is, and Ottila is her friend, I should mention, she's just sort of like part of the bed. She's totally passive, and that's a huge part of what her character is too, right? So again, you're someone who is being forced in this position, and you have no choice but to sort of passively observe, passively take it. However, there has to be something more nuanced. There has to be something more nuanced than just like, I'm this totally passive communist subject, and I'm the other one, I'm the totally proactive, gonna find a way around this bureaucratic red tape communist subject, right? So again, the point of the film is not abortion. The point of the film is something entirely different. And I think, you know, again, if a woman had made it, that might not have been the case.
Among female-directed movies, some notable ones would be Agnes Varda's One Sings, the Other Doesn't, as well as Amy Heckerling's Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I know that I was a little caught off guard by that when I saw it as a younger man.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that there is an abortion in it, which you don't expect to see in a teen comedy, especially one that The Box always has Sean Penn as Spicoli, you know, looking like a goof. You don't expect an abortion to be in it. And you also don't expect that it'll happen, you know, two-thirds of the way in, then the movie will continue after that and everything is basically going to be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really genius move, and I have a lot of respect for Amy Heckerling for making this teen movie that really shows a lot of extremes of puberty, right? You know, because you also, in addition to Spicoli, oh my God, he's so crazy, we also have Judd Hirsch getting really horny when the woman comes out, you know, having a fantasy and jerking off and then getting caught jerking off.
Man, I hate to have to publicly own you, but it was Mr. Judge Reinhold in that.
Judge Reinhold! Oh, fuck. Okay. So you have Judge Reinhold, you know, getting horny to the Cars, yeah, while the Cars play, and then getting caught jerking off and blah, blah, you know.
Iconic.
Being ostracized for it.
Yeah.
But then he redeems himself by being there for his sister, which is a really, I mean, again, I think it's a very smart move. You know, it's almost as smart as Clueless, which is a very smart film, which for years I had written off as like dumb teen comedy. It's something where you really get a sense of brother and sister stuff, right? And it's not this corny sort of fake Hollywood thing. It's just sort of like he's there for her in a position where no one else could be there for her. And it's beautiful, but they also don't linger on it.
Let this be your secret. You all right?
Yeah.
Come on. You hungry?
Yeah.
I have to admit, I haven't seen One Sings, The Other Doesn't. I'm very ashamed of that. Tell us a little bit about that one. I know, I'm not a good ally.
Well, here's the thing. So there are parts of One Sings and The Other Doesn't that don't age so well. However, before Varda had this really fascinating documentary turn, you know, hybrid documentary turn in the early 80s, she made this film that is just completely, It's very strange, where it's a musical that's kind of using all of this wordplay to talk about these women who are French. They do have to go abroad to secure an abortion. And again, like in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there are these real celebrations of pregnancy and women saying, I love to be pregnant. I love to be a mother. And then there are other women who are like, that's absolutely not for me, at least not right now. It has a very playful tone. There's a lot of wordplay with, you know, rhyming things that really are super serious things. Again, I mean, talking about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, this is a film that will genuinely, you'll just be very kind of taken aback a lot of the time. And I think it's something that Agnes Varda is, she really doesn't get enough credit for, because she has this real ability to take things that are not, you know, like something like Le Bonheur, or something like Les Créatures, which is a very almost Brechtian take on creativity and this tiny little village in the middle of France. I mean, One Sings and the Other Doesn't has all of these elements that I think are erased when we talk about, or when we see photos of like cute grandma Agnes Varda, where she's like sleeping or she's bouncing the ball, like, you know, all this shit that removes her truly radical edge. And I think abortion had only recently been legalized in France when she made it, and it's compelling. And I think it's something that someone who was either very pro-choice or very anti-choice could sit down and watch and have something to say. And even though that's obviously never the point of a film, just to please both sides, I think there's something there for everyone to kind of meditate on. The one part, though, that does not age well is the fact that this one woman, she hooks up with like this cute Iranian guy, she's abroad, and then she goes back to Iran, and then like as soon as she gets pregnant, he gets like super, super, super conservative and like the worst caricature of like evil Eastern man that you could possibly imagine. But other than that, it's a very fair depiction of like the economic realities of having children and the physical, the responsibility, the emotional responsibility, what it does to relationships, stuff like that. The kind of the kookiness of the songs meets up with this very measured consideration of what child rearing means for women in France at that time. Le juge ou le docteur ou le législateur qui me feront la loi.
When I think of abortion movies, I think of a few, I guess from maybe the 90s or the 2000s, it felt to me like there was a wave, and maybe it isn't even a wave, maybe it's like a half dozen or three or four movies that are sort of both sides abortion movies. I'm thinking in particular of Alexander Payne's Citizen Ruth, where
yes.
It's been forever since I've seen it, but my memory is that Laura Dern plays a kind of dim-witted working-class woman who gets pregnant, and she finds herself caught in the midst of a culture war between rather grotesque caricatures on each side, including, I think, Burt Reynolds as a pro-life or anti-choice guy. I also think yes. of Todd Solondz's Palindromes. Did you ever see Palindromes? Todd Solondz is a bit of a blast from the past to bring his name up.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean you're never going to get married and have children?
I have no innate desire to get married or have kids. That's beyond my control. Since the planet's fast running out of natural resources and we won't survive to the next century.
What if you're wrong?
Well, here's the funny story. I went to South by Southwest the year that Palindromes premiered, and I was the first person in line because I was so eager to see it. And like I sat down in front of the theater like 2 hours before, and then all of my friends who came with me also sat down like at the very head of the line. And so we all went in. And that movie, nothing about him ages particularly well right now. He's very against the time. And I mean, you know, obviously, again, Palindromes, ostensibly the point of the film is that abortion is not the point. This is about how lives of different people, of different teenage girls can be absolutely the same no matter what. However, worth noting that the teenage actress who plays the version of Aviva who gets pregnant is a plus-size black actress.
The gimmick of this movie was that the central girl character was played by seven or eight different girls and women, including Jennifer Jason Leigh, I think was the most famous one.
Right.
Of varying ages and races. By any chance, did you see Tony Kaye's Lake of Fire, which was kind of a minor cause celebre in the mid-2000s? Tony Kaye, of course, was the director of American History X, and his follow-up 10 years later was this mammoth, I think, three-hour documentary about abortion that was sort of determined to be like the definitive abortion documentary and also to sort of take no sides. And it was shot in black and white. I think when you watch it, it comes down on the pro-choice side on points, because most of the anti-choice people that he interviews are pretty wacky people, except for Nat Hentoff, who's in it. He's kind of the voice of sober opposition.
But what is sober opposition when it comes to an issue like this? I mean, Kevin Williamson, for fuck's sake.
His case, which was approvingly cited in many of the reviews of the film at the time, was that You can be against abortion, but you've also got to be against the death penalty and war and all these other things that conservatives typically are not against.
That's my response.
The film also depicted abortion procedures and showed the aftermath of them because, as Tony Kaye said, he felt that he had to do justice to the other side, so he had to actually show what it looked like. I have no comment on that. I'm simply saying what an unpleasant viewing experience this 3 hour abortion documentary was.
Because I mean, there are, you know, obviously we don't really have time to get into it, but there is this whole culture, conservative anti-choice culture. There's a really great article by Kristen Dombeck called The Two Cultures of Life, which was published in N Plus One probably like 10 years ago. And she talks about growing up anti-choice, and one of the most fascinating things in it to me is that she talks about how, you know, at her church, her youth group would be sent to Washington, D.C. with all these other youth groups to protest. And I mean, when there's charges of, you know, George Soros doing paid protests, well, that's because the fucking Koch brothers have been doing paid protests for the past 25 years. Like, it is a thing, but it's not happening where you think it is. So And of course, there's like the famous film, The Silent Scream, which she writes about watching. So when an abortion procedure is slowed down, the meaning and the action, what is actually happening, is completely changed. So in this footage, it looks like the fetus opens its mouth and screams. And so, of course, if that is your only exposure to abortion, and you're like, well, that's fact. I saw that. That's with my own eyes. That's fact. That thing is alive and is sentient and it feels pain. Not provable. Kind of irrelevant, I would argue. So there is definitely that rhetorical. And I mean, even just looking at the sorts of restrictions that have been placed on abortion in states, even before, quote, the abortion bans took place, you know, there's so many places where you can't get, you know, there's one clinic in the state, you have to go back multiple times. In South Dakota, for instance, doctors are required to tell women that, quote, abortion will terminate the life of a whole separate, unique, living human being. And also tell you that you might experience depression or you might attempt suicide, and that, you know, maybe, hey, the state might be able to pay for your child care. If you choose to keep it, please keep it. Like, that sort of fucked up stuff. So, I mean, I think, again, because there is so much silence about this in media, because it is, you know, such a, quote unquote, such a touchy topic, there are these really radical sides that are, they're completely disingenuous, that just want to use abortion as a wedge issue, who can take control, and they can start to dictate the conversation. And then again, you're backed into the corner as someone who is pro-choice, trying to say like, oh yeah, well, no, it doesn't, the baby doesn't feel anything. Oops, I called it a baby. Oh no, like you're fucked. So I know in, you know, over the past year, Donald Trump's presidency has not resulted in the resurrection of punk rock. However, there have been a lot of TV shows that have dealt with abortion, women of different races, different social statuses, you know, not just the Elizabeth Moss Handmaid's Tale stuff, like actual TV shows, non-prestige TV shows. And all the better, because it's clearly like liberals have lost the actual political war, and we're in very bad danger of losing the culture war. So the more you can talk about abortions with your friends, abortions with your little cousins, whoever, just talk about it. Tell them to go see A Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
That seems like the correct note to end it on. So thank you, Violet.
Thank you, Will. Nobody else could ever love me this way.